When we say the short symphony, where does that fit in with the three symphonies?
Well, the short symphony is a particular favorite of mine among the symphonies just because it doesn't get played very much. When it was brand new, I think it was really quite technically difficult for an orchestra. The rhythms were unusual, I think, unconventional, certainly, and not easy to immediately toss off by even a good professional orchestra. So that it remains one of my pieces, which I think is one of the best things I've written, and is probably least played of most of my works. And of course, every composer feels most tender about those works which are not played so much. The ones that are played a great deal, the composer tends to take for granted. I mean, why wouldn't they play it, you know?
What other works fall into that category?
Not so many. Well, of course, one's opera doesn't get performed that much. I wrote an opera called The Tender Land in three acts. It's meant to be a proper opera, not for the Met, but for a lyric theater with the more modest pretensions. And I can't say it's been a wild hit.
And yet, I expect that, the quintet, The Promise of Life, will probably
Promise
be around.
Promise of Living, yes.
Promise of Living will probably be around as long as anyone's listening to music, don't you imagine?
I hope you're right. I don't think the libretto that I used was that fascinating from a theatrical standpoint. The fellow who wrote it was a friend of mine. I thought it would be easy to work with him. I could ask him to change things and he wouldn't be upset, that kind of thing. But he wasn't a real pro. And considering that he wasn't, I think he got away with quite a lot. But I noticed that it has been taken on, not by the big opera companies, which it wasn't really designed for, but in more modest opera activities and universities and places like that.
This sounds terribly simple-minded of me to say this, but I was just this season, I listened to a very big production, well, from San Francisco, of Samson and Delilah. Yeah. And I kept thinking to myself, now, why in the Sam Hill don't we have an Aaron Copland epical drama like that? Why don't you really get busy on that? You can do it marvelously.
Why didn't you come around 20 years ago and suggest that? You really want me to do things that are tough to do.
Well, yeah, but it seems that we're missing that in our vocabulary, if I may say so.
And by that you mean?
A large work with the Copland sound and the personality there.
Well, I suppose The Tender Land was meant to sound like me. It's a lyric opera. It isn't one of those big dramatic numbers where somebody gets murdered. But it's only had a kind of a modest go, I would say. It hasn't really caught on.
Tell us about the suite. How do you extract a suite from an opera?
Well, I don't think there's any general principle you follow, except that naturally you take those parts which seem to be able to transcribe the vocal sections of the opera adequately in instrumental terms. And not all operas lend themselves to that kind of treatment. I think The Tender Land, I think I got away with that particular problem fairly well.
Frankly, what flaws do you find in it? Because I don't find any. I find
flaws in the opera?
In the opera. I find all the characters just very tender, very, very true.
Well, you're saying just what I'd like to hear. It isn't a very strong, dramatic line, you know. The audience isn't going to be knocked out of their seats by what they see on the stage. It's a lyric work meant to be rather tender and feelingful. There's even a dance scene in the second act that's lively. But I used a friend of mine to write the libretto. I let him go ahead when he suggested he'd like to. And I suppose if I had worked with a real pro, someone who had written many plays and knew the theater very well, we might have concocted a more exciting dramatic line. Some changes certainly would have been made. But I'm hoping that in some of the productions that I've seen, that the music carried the comparatively simple plot along adequately, and it's meant to make a kind of warm and personal feeling rather than a big dramatic number on the operatic stage.
It also seems to deal with something, some aspect of this country and of our history that is almost like a long-lost age. I mean, it's like so much of the writers of the 20s and the 30s. Mm-hmm. Even though it was a fairly dreadful period economically, There's a nostalgia about that period that doesn't seem to die out, and then the Tenderland seems to fit right into that.
I never thought of it in those terms, but I think you've got something there.
Speaking of your children, you cannot say that the music for the Appalachian Spring is in any way neglected at all. How do you feel about this music so many years now after it's been...
I feel very good, as a matter of fact. The fate of pieces is really rather curious. You don't always figure it out in advance is exactly what's going to... figure out what exactly is going to happen to them.
As a boy, I came from Upper Appalachia.
Did you?
And I know that when
what
I...
What is Upper Appalachia?
Oh, Southern Ohio, the foothills of the Appalachian hills there. And I recall distinctly, it was about World War II, hearing the Appalachian Spring for the first time. It was
really?
A big... It was an album of records, I think it was Koussevitzky and the Boston
Very
Symphony.
Possibly, yeah.
And I thought to myself, that didn't sound any more like Appalachia in my mind than the Man the Moon. But you know there is an entire generation of Americans who, when they hear that music, think of the Appalachian region. You have given voice to that region.
Could be. But don't forget, I gave voice to that region without knowing that I was giving voice to it, since I didn't know what it was going to be called, and I was not thinking about the Appalachian Mountains when I wrote it. People are very disappointed to hear me say that. They like to think that I sat down knowing what the piece was going to be called, and I was putting the Appalachians into musical terms.
But you have, and no one has done it more beautifully.
Well, you can credit Martha Graham with that. She must have something Appalachian in her personality, because I was really thinking about her when I was writing it, and her dance style.
Permit me another observation. In my first experience with Copland music was a song which kept appearing on recitals. One was called The Dodger, and another was called By the River.
Yes.
Well, Let Us Gather by the River, the famous hymn. The Dodger wasn't, but that song was still sung when I was a youngster in southeastern Ohio.
Yes.
And I, at the time, thought, what has he done to that song? Mm-hmm. You had arranged it for piano. And, of course, the piano part seemed to me, well, I was taking piano lessons and it seemed to be a little bit beyond me even, but it seemed to me that there were two things going on, the song and Copland's feeling for it.
Uh-huh.
Was I right?
Are you saying that my accompaniment was too complex for a nice, simple song?
It was for me at the time, but as I say now, I can't conceive of it any other way.
Uh-huh.
Even when Charles Ives takes the same melody
and
works it over.
Well, it's fascinating to work with folk materials because there's a kind of forced simplicity implied in the working. You don't want to fancify it or dress it up or make it something it isn't meant to be. So that it's a kind of a challenge to see how interesting you can be as a composer within a comparatively small frame.
I spoke about the piano accompaniments to those because as I stand back now, do you mind if I make an observation? I prefer the original piano accompaniments to the orchestrations.
Yes.
How do you account for that?
Well, I can ask the same question of you. How do you account for it? I'm comfortable with both the piano and the orchestral version.
Well, I think I would have to account for it.
Does it seem too dressed up for you?
No.
No.
No, it doesn't.
Good.
As a matter of fact, being of my age in this country, I'm very much used to hearing songs with orchestral accompaniments because that's the way you would invariably get them on recordings and on the radio.
Yeah, true enough.
And it wasn't until later that I realized some of the very best songs were written simply with piano accompaniment.
Mm-hmm.
And then later realized that there was also a huge tradition of the orchestral song going back to Berlioz. And then, so I loved the original setting with the piano because they have the breath of morning dew on them. They're so fresh. But on the other hand, the orchestral things are part of a great tradition. Which do you prefer?
I like them both.
You're not weaseling on me.
I'm not?
You're not weaseling on me, are you?
No. No, I like them both. They make a different impression. I mean, an orchestral version is in a bigger hall with a larger audience and a different setting.
Are you a pianist or a composer or a conductor? You seem to do all of them. You seem
Can't
to be a triple
be
threat
all?
There. Well, apparently you can.
I'm a latecomer as a conductor. I would have started conducting much earlier than I did. But my great friend Serge Koussevitzky, then head of the Boston Symphony, used to shake his finger at me and say, "You must not waste your time conducting. You must stay home and compose." And that was probably very good advice. But as soon as he died, I started to conduct. It was sort of a suppressed passion. After all, if you sat in an audience or a rehearsal as often as I have, watching other people conduct your music, you may think, I'll never do it as well as he does, but still, there's a sort of a yen. Just get up there once and conduct it the way you think you dreamt it in the beginning. And it is a great satisfaction after you get sufficient confidence as a conductor, technical confidence. It is a great satisfaction to conduct your own music, I find, in spite of the fact that I might agree with someone that someone else will do it better than I can. Leonard Bernstein, for instance, who knows my music backwards and forwards.
Of course, he's been in on so much of these, many of these compositions, has he not?
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm.
Why would Koussevitzky warn you away from
conducting? Well, it is a time-consuming affair. You don't just get up and conduct an orchestra. You have to, after you feel competent, you can't just go around picking orchestras. They have to pick you, so it's a sort of a serious distraction for a composer to attempt to do too much conducting while he's trying to write music. I think he was right to have sort of held me back. But it was a suppressed passion, and after he died, I started to conduct.
I just can't imagine what it would be like. Did you learn things about your children that you didn't know?
Well, you learn a lot by sitting in a rehearsal room and watching a conductor conduct it. And if you've seen 10 different conductors conduct the same piece, you get different versions and different ideas about what the piece might sound like. All that's very helpful when you get up to do it in the way you think you dreamt it in the very beginning. And it is, if the orchestra is really first class and the audience is receptive, it's a real pleasure to be able to do both as a performer and as a composer on the same evening before a receptive audience.
The Lincoln Portrait is unquestionably your most beloved work.
I would think it would be Appalachian Spring. That's
Do
my
you
impression
think so?
From sort of reactions I get, you know.
Mm-hmm. Was there any precept for the Lincoln Portrait?
What do you mean? You mean some example?
I know of no other staple, serious concert work
really?
Of that nature. And none comes to mind right now.
Not immediately, but there must be something. You mean a speaker with orchestra?
It just seems to me that it came right fresh.
Yes, I was just wondering if I could name another example right off the top of my head. Nothing immediately jumps to mind. I remember thinking at the time when I decided to use a text, I also had other possible writers or speech makers to think about, but I no longer remember exactly who they were and how I ended up by deciding to do Lincoln. I also don't quite remember, except that it comes to me now that I was reading a biography of Abraham Lincoln by an English lord. Lord Charnwood. I picked it up someplace at a railroad station in a paperback, and I got some of the things quoted in my Lincoln Portrait from that book. He quoted Lincoln as having said that such and such in a speech someplace out lost in the Midwest. So that was a lucky chance, having my having found that book. I thought it was so odd for an English lord to want to write an autobiography of Lincoln.
Were you close friends with Virgil Thompson?
Oh, yes, for 60 years. Mm-hmm. I met him when I was a student in Paris, living there, and he was already an early settler then. He had lived there for several years. And he was a big help because he knew all the works and, I mean, all how everything worked in Paris. And I'd ask him for advice about this, that, and the other. He's changed very little over the years. He developed early, really early, his personality in so complete a way that it's astonishing. Very consistent.
I don't know which I find more enchanting, some of his writing about music some of his music.
Yeah, that's true. He's a terrific writer about music. He has no fear, I don't think. The freshness in which he continues to write, you know, is extraordinary. He's even older than I am, if you can think of such a thing. He's 84, I think. He was born in 96.
I met him at a reception once in Otterbein University in Ohio. They were doing a whole series of his things.
Yeah.
At a reception afterwards, he was a teeny-weeny bit bored, I think, because there was no liquor being served. So I just decided, I'd never met him before, and someone said that one of his great passions was dancing. And, he physically didn't look like someone whose great passion was dancing. So I asked him, more or less as a test, I said, tell me, what is the difference between a valse hésitation and a valse boston? Mm-hmm. He immediately went into a dance around the floor, struck the hostess, spilled a bottle of punch, and never stopped. And I learned instantly what the difference was. Can we talk about Paris? Because to me, and I get very emotional when I think about this, someone like Nadia Boulanger, I really can't grasp.
Really?
I can't grasp how her mind worked. She turned out so many students, and yet none of them sound like a pupil of Nadia Boulanger or anyone else. They all sound like original, natural people. How did she accomplish that?
Well, she knew how to look at a page of music, or even a half a page of music, dispassionately, and to judge it in terms of what that particular student sitting next to her was able to accomplish. She could sort of guess for you not one way the piece might be developed, but three different ways or four different ways without telling you what to do, so that she was both very sure in her musical reactions about what she thought and how she judged things. You had the confidence in her that if she thought something was not really right for a certain spot in the piece, it really couldn't have been really right. One trusted her musical instincts completely. I think most of her students would agree with that statement. So that she brought a very wide knowledge of music to her judgment. She knew the oldest music and the latest music. And not all teachers could do that. I had a good teacher in New York who had no connection really with the music of his own time, Reuben Goldbach. You see, and to me that was a great lack in him. And that was not at all true of Nadia. She was completely at home, either with the 18th century or with the 20th century. And one can be pretty sure when she thought there was something the matter with a piece and could tell you in detail what it was, that she was right. It would be very rare for me to think, oh no, this time she's wrong. That kind of security in her reaction, not to a finished piece, but a piece in the course of being made, was very, very special, I think.
She was also...
She came from a very musical family, you know. Both her father was a professor at the Conservatoire, and her younger sister, Lily, of course, was the first French woman in French history to win the famous Prix de Rome. And everybody became aware of her through that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What did you write for her, for example?
Well, I primarily wrote my Symphony for Organ and Orchestra, which is the first orchestral work I heard in performance. She was greatly admired by Walter Damrosch and also by Koussevitzky. She was the first one who brought me to Koussevitzky.
Well, then, in addition to you, we could almost say that Koussevitzky also greatly assisted in bringing many, many young composers to the American mind.
Oh,
how about Prokofiev? He was an acquaintance of Koussevitzky's, was he not?
Very much so.
Did you ever meet him?
Prokofiev?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He was living in Paris then. I remember going to Koussevitzky's in order to play him sections from a ballet I was working on, with hoping that he'd say, "We'll make a suite for us and we'll play it in Boston." He had just been named the new conductor of the Boston Symphony. Well, when I got there, to my horror, there was Prokofiev visiting Koussevitzky. So when I sat down to play the thing for Koussevitzky, Prokofiev was standing right behind me. And it made me sort of self-conscious to have a composer who'd be very critical, as a composer would, or some from some the music of some young American he never heard of. So I played it, and as soon as I got to the end, before Koussevitzky or I could say anything, he said in French, "Too many Bessi ostinati." I could have murdered him.
What do you mean by bassi ostinati? You mean the left hand too much?
Well, it's an obstinate bass.
Yes.
Say it does the same thing all the time. Bum, 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 and a bum, 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 and bum, bum.
You mean Prokofiev had the nerve to criticize you for that?
Yes, well, I mean, I was a student, after all, in those days. Nobody had ever heard of me, so he didn't feel he was doing anything awful. But he was prejudicing my case with Koussevitzky, who I wanted to have play this in Boston when he got there.
Well, did you have other, perhaps more fortunate experiences with Prokofiev? What was he like? Did you know him much?
Yeah, I didn't know him much, but I met him on several occasions. He was very lively. He was a sort of a bad boy type. He loved saying things that he knew would upset somebody. He wasn't kind. I wouldn't think of him as kind, exactly. But he was very sharp, and what he said was generally had some point to it, and he was right about my piece.
You might say you had some very good critical input during those days.
Yes.
But to have Prokofiev looking over your shoulder, oh, I'm sure it was a distraction, but this was also, what did you think of him mostly, as a composer or as a teacher or as a pianist? Because it seems
Prokofiev,
to me he was one of the great concert pianists, wasn't he?
He was a very fine pianist, but I thought of him as a composer, of course. He was there in his capacity as composer, and his music was being played then in Paris, in the orchestral performances especially, and he was giving concerts himself of his own music. He was a very good pianist, you know.
But I can't get over Boulanger. Did she take many people really under her wing like that and say, "Look, here's the conductor," or did she have a special affection for you?
I wouldn't really know. But if she believed in somebody, she was perfectly capable of doing that. After all, when I studied with her, I don't think she had that many American students. She must have had some. You see, I first heard of her in the books now. They say, "I went to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger." Once a thing like that gets printed, everybody else who writes a book copies it. You never can correct it. You never catch up with it. The fact is, when I went to Paris, I had never heard of Nadia Boulanger. I couldn't possibly have gone to study with someone I never heard of. But I was sort of scared of going to France all alone, not knowing anybody there, though I wanted to study in Paris because that's where the action seemed to be. Stravinsky was living there, and the group of six with Poulenc and Mio and so forth were all there. So that seemed to be the exciting place to go. The older generation than mine all had gone to Germany to study. Germany was rather looked down upon. The war had just finished in 18, and this was 21. And the new music seemed to be coming from Paris, and Stravinsky was living in Paris. That was a big draw. So I headed for Paris. And as I say, the books say I went to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger, but that is absolutely not true. I never heard of her, so I couldn't possibly have gone to study with someone I never heard of. But I was sort of scared to go to Paris all by myself, not knowing a living soul there. And one day, I read in the Musical America magazine that the French government, as a gesture of appreciation to the Americans for having helped them in the First World War, was starting a summer music school for American music students in the Palace of Fontainebleau. Well, I thought, I won't be alone if I go into that school. I may not learn anything. Who cares? It's just for 2 months anyhow, but it'll be a way of not being alone in France. So I got to the New York office to sign up so fast, they said, you're the first student to join the school. And it served that purpose. It was very good because I wasn't lonely. I was with a bunch of fellow Americans. I had a chance to practice my French for 2 months, such as it was. And I was turned over to the top composition teacher at the Conservatoire, who was teaching this two-month course. Well, he was an old dodo. He didn't have anything for me at all. He was very conventional in his ideas, and he thought Stravinsky was a madman. That wasn't at all the idea of going to France to study with anyone like that. But some gal who sat next to me at the lunch table every day started enthusing to me about a harmony teacher called Nadia Boulanger and said, you really ought to go and visit her class. I said, I am not interested in harmony. I've had 3 years of harmony. I don't want to hear about harmony. She said, oh, no, no, just go and see the way she does it. So I went. There was something about the warmth with which she was talking about this dull subject of harmony. All of a sudden, harmony seemed like the very basis of all the art of music, you know. It took on an aspect that I hadn't really quite grasped as being so grand. And so very gradually, I was still not a student of hers. This was during the 2 months at the Fontainebleau Music School. And then in the fall, we were all going to separate, and I was going to Paris to continue my studies with somebody. I didn't know who, but somebody. Very gradually, I started to think, I would like to study composition with that woman. But then I hesitated, because I couldn't think in the whole history of music of any famous composer who had ever studied composition with a lady. I thought, am I going to be the first? I talked myself into it. It was the smartest thing I ever did. I can't imagine what my musical career in music would have been like without her. And it was not only lessons and her musical sensitivity that was involved, but when it was announced in the paper that Koussevitzky was named the new head of the Boston Symphony, she said to me, we must go and visit him. And sure enough, we went and visited him. And by the time we were ready to leave, he said, you will write a symphony for organ, and Mademoiselle will come to America and play it, and I will conduct it. I couldn't believe my ears. I had never orchestrated never heard an orchestration of mine. I had never written a piece that lasted 20 minutes. I was working on a ballet which had different short sections. So I said to her, do you think I can do it? You can do it, she said. Well, that's a discussion. Once she said, you can do it, I did it.
But I'm still impressed that she came to this country and performed it in New York and Boston.
She did.
Did she play it well?
Very. She was an excellent organist. Everything she did well. She was one of those people. That was real luck to have found her as a teacher. You have to have some luck in this world. I would have sent a study with somebody in Paris, but it probably wouldn't have been the same thing.
Did you meet Stravinsky in Paris?
Yes I did.
Mm-hmm.
She took me to his house and for tea or whatever it was, and introduced me as a young American composer.
What did he think of that?
What did he think of it?
Yeah.
Well, he was a pretty tough baby, Stravinsky. He didn't, he wasn't kindly. He didn't sort of stroke you on the back and say, oh, well, write good music, dear. None of that. He was a toughie. But very smart.
Do you enjoy his music?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Most of it?
Yes. Well, it was the hottest thing around. When I was in Paris, that was the new thing, you see. It wasn't the world-famous Stravinsky yet, but he was well on the way. He was such a short guy. All these great composers were so short.
Did you feel you sort of towered over them?
I towered, oh yes. It was a little embarrassing. But the two key people in my musical career, certainly in the early years, was Koussevitzky and Boulanger. What my career would have been like without those two, I cannot fathom, I can't imagine.
Actually, your Third Symphony, I gather, seems to have been tailor-made for Koussevitzky and the Boston Symphony, was it?
I would say so, yes. Well, I'd say it was made with them in mind. I knew the kind of music Koussevitzky liked, big sound and sort of ambitious and of a certain length. And of course, I knew the sound of the Boston Symphony very well.
Would that account for the great brass work?
Could.
Mm-hmm.
Up to a point. After all, you have to write the music you're going to write, but it is fun to know what orchestra is going to play it and to have in your ears the sound of that orchestra.
Again, harking back to Prokofiev for no reason, it puts me in mind that if I had to talk about my favorite Prokofiev pieces, I'm inclined to think the piano pieces.
Yes.
And I'm inclined to feel the same way about you.
Really?
Yes. I think, well, there's one piece, one work of yours, which every time I hear it, I have the feeling I've heard something new, and those are the piano variations.
Oh, well, good.
You fond of that work? Please tell me you are.
I certainly am. I certainly am. I like the three principal piano works I did, the Variations, the Piano Sonata, and the Piano Fantasy. That work of mine lasts 1/2 hour without pause, and when you dare do a thing like that, you have to pay the price that not many people are willing to sit and listen to a piece that starts 1 minute and finishes 30 minutes later without pause, and certainly not many pianists are willing to put such a piece before an audience. You have to really believe in it to want to take the chance.
But you have some marvelous people who believe in it. I mean,
I've had good luck.
Marcellus, and yes, Leo Smit, and Paul Jacobs.
Oh, you're very well read.
Yes. Well, these are the people who will carry you on forever, won't they?
I hope so. Somebody's got to. I can't imagine what it must have been like in the days when composers had no recordings of their music available. To base a career on the success of a single performance occasionally someplace or other. And of course they used to issue four-hand piano arrangements of orchestral works, and many people got familiar with the works that way. It wasn't certainly the same thing as having a recording such as we have now, the full orchestral panoply there. So we are really lucky to belong to a generation that didn't have the music recorded and available without having to go to a concert. Not in the same way, of course. It sounds better in my ears at a concert, but still, it's better than nothing.
And Ives was born, what, about, 60 miles away over in Danbury.
Yeah, huh? That's right, Danbury, Connecticut.
Yeah.
I was always very sorry I never met Ives. One day I received in the mail a package. I opened the package, and it was 114 songs by Charles Ives, sent like that out of the blue. Nobody asked for it. Published at his own expense. I thought, what a strange phenomenon that a composer would have enough money to publish 114 songs and just send them around unasked to whomever he happened to pick out. Seemed like such an odd event. I couldn't think of any parallel thing. I got very interested when I opened that volume and started to examine the songs. The variety of song was what astonished me. From the cheapest little two-page nothing that you wouldn't dream of publishing in your right mind, to the most unsingable monster.
From Ann Street to General William Booth Enters into Heaven.
That's right. Well, I was so impressed that I sat down and wrote an article about that volume, and it was published in Modern Music magazine. And then I got a nice note from him thanking me for the article. And so I wanted to meet him. And I mentioned that to some people who knew him, and they said, oh, you mustn't. I said, why not? Well, he says he has a very bad heart condition. He gets very excited when he meets new people. You're liable to be the end of him. Well, I didn't want to be the end of him, so I never pressed it, and I never did meet him. But in years later, I discovered there were other people who were meeting him, and I felt sort of chipped that I hadn't had the opportunity.
Yes, I imagine you did.
To write 114 songs, no matter what quality, is quite a feat. But to have this money, your own money, to spend on publishing and then sending it around unasked to people who might have thrown it in the waste paper basket if they weren't interested, that seemed very, very remarkable to me.
You're going to have to forgive me for saying this, but I have a distinct feeling of great honor, you know, sitting here talking with you, a man who has accomplished all you have. It's somewhat in the nature of being invited to sit in and talk with Johannes Brahms.
You're being very flattering.
Well, I'm not only being flattering, I'm going to ask you a question which I'm sure have been asked you 100,000 times, and I dare say you've not, well, I don't know. I'll find out how good you are at answering it. I read a volume recently by a gentleman who had spent a lot of time in Austria toward the end of Brahms' life, and he got a stenographer. What do they call those people who can write down what you say? Stenographer. Mm-hmm. And he and Brahms, and I can't remember his name, but he and Brahms and Joachim sat down, and this fellow's interest was, how does a composer become inspired? How does he write music? Brahms did say, he says, yeah, you sort of let yourself go. You sort of relax and you permit music to come to you, and then ideas come that way. Is that general? I mean, does music sort of take shape in your mind?
It would be very hard. I think it would be very hard to generalize.
Apparently.
Just how it works with everybody. They all probably work differently. I mean, those composers who are lucky enough to write music without the aid of an instrument and just sit here at the desk, and if they're in the mood, they hurriedly jot down what occurs to them. It's not quite as easy when you need an instrument in order to compose. And mostly the mere presence of an instrument can be an attraction and suggest to you that you'd like to work at it a bit. I don't ever remember being in a room without an instrument involved and having a terrific yen to make music. It's the actual presence of the instrument that seems to invite the making of music.
Whenever I've heard you perform on the piano, it's always been brilliant. The piano is your instrument, and you play it well, don't you?
I hope you're right there. Brilliant, I wouldn't have... I don't have enough technique, the security of technique, to be really brilliant. Maybe when I was in my 20s, but certainly no more.
Mm-hmm. And your early experience with the piano then must have been, I mean, as a child, must have been pretty successful.
Yes, my earliest memories actually is hanging around the piano. I was the youngest of five, you see. When my older sister was practicing her scales, and she'd say to me, "Aaron, why are you hanging around here? Why don't you go out and play with the other kids in the street?" Something was holding my attention. I couldn't have said what it was. Of course, it was the sound of music. So it was pretty basic. The attraction was pretty basic. Nobody in our family had any artistic leanings in a professional sense. I mean, my oldest brother played the violin nicely, and my sister accompanied him. But there, it was a very large family of cousins by the dozens, and no musicians, no artists in any field anywhere, all good business people. So where it came from, I never did find out.
When I say the Copland sound, do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, I probably have more sounds in my head than just a Copland sound, and so in that sense, it's more confusing. I could tell you whether a piece had reminded somebody that someone else had written had spots that reminded me of my own music. That I could tell you, but
how would you spot it?
I don't know. It's a matter of empathy and a sort of a matter of recognition. I can't describe it to you. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a little dangerous for a composer to become too conscious of what his particular sound is, because then he'll be producing nothing but his sound. It should be more spontaneous than that. You write something, and think, "Oh, this is great," and then somebody says, "Oh, it sounds just like you."
Tell me one thing I've always really wanted to hear you talk about. The 1920s, you know, the post-war era, was probably very exciting, particularly, well, Ernest Ansermé, for example, wrote this great article on American jazz and its potential and its possibility and its energy, and yeah, of course it did soon spread around the world. And yet I don't gather that that was a huge generating force for you as a composer. Am I mistaken?
The jazz, you mean? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have thought of it as a generating force. That really gives it a big name. No, but it was a way, and that's what attracted me to it, of writing a recognizably American music. It solved the problem of being nationalistic up to a point in your music. See, I was very aware of how French the French music seemed in those days. And looking for an American idiom, naturally, it was a help to know that it had been created in a field that I considered light music. And very attractively, the whole world recognized it as American, so it must have been American. And so the idea came to my head, well, I'd love to be able to do that in the field of so-called serious music, concert music.
Where do you feel you've done it best?
Oh, gosh.
I say the piano concerto, and then, of course, the piano blues.
Yeah, I'd say the same. I think there's some parts of the piano variations, for instance, which not everybody might recognize as that of an American composer, I think also to have... would have been different if I wasn't familiar with jazz rhythms and jazz feeling. Or nobody would call the variations jazzy. I don't think, no. It was a help to know that some composers had developed a style, even though it was only in light music, that the whole world could recognize that that must be American popular music. That was a stimulus.
Does make you feel like some sort of patriarch that people don't ask that question much anymore? They'll say, what's American music? They say, well, Aaron Copland's American music. And it's true, isn't it?
I hope so. Well, the result is, of course, that the younger generation of composers are not at all interested in being American sounding in their music. They have a feeling, well, it's been done, who needs it?
Do you have great affection for the younger generation of American composers?
I? Mm-hmm. Well, in principle, I do. I wouldn't want to be pinned down to examples, but it'd be a sad world if you couldn't believe in what the younger generation were up to.
Mm. All right. Since you are about to achieve the grand old age of, what is it, 80? Are you going to be 80?
I'm afraid so. Next week, to be exact. It's been threatening me for some years, and it's awful to think it's next year, next week.
What have you missed? What would you have done? No, come on, what would you have done if you had another 80 years?
Oh, you mean musically what I missed?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, no one's ever asked me that. I've never thought about it. Seemed like a useless thing to think about since you're not going to have another 80 years. What have I missed? It would have been nice to have written a really grand opera in the grand manner. I wrote an opera in three acts, but it's lyrical. It's sort of opera lyrique. That would have been fun, with a big chorus and, you know, ambitious. Meistersinger kind of.
Oh, boy. Mm-hmm. Do you compose? Do you think about composing? I'm sure you think about music a lot, don't you?
Well, I live the life of a musician, basically. But if you've had 50 or 60 years in which to express yourself, that's a pretty long time. And you don't really think, gee, isn't it awful that I'm not composing anymore? You kind of feel lucky you had the 50 or 60 years and let it go at that. Rest easy. That's more or less the way I feel. Since it's useless anyhow to sit around moaning about the fact that you're not producing anymore. See, most composers never lived to my great age, so they never had to think how you worry about how you go on after 55 or 60. Poor devils.